You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today we have not some tasty treats. We got some sour treats for you. We got Ben Vinegar on. That's pretty awful. I was trying to think. I was like, should I do like a Vic Vinegar joke? Or
I knew where it was going, and I was ready. I was, you know, my mind and body were ready for it. So
Ben is works at actually one of our sponsors. We're not having him on because he's a sponsor. We're having him on because we're actually interested in what he has to say. He works at Sentry, and he's got all kinds of stuff that we could talk about. I followed what Ben has been doing for many, many years ago. You used to work at like what? FreshBooks, right?
Yeah, I was one of the single digit employees of FreshBooks, but
that's a long, long time ago. That was probably
Do the listeners know about FreshBooks?
FreshBooks is he's joking. Okay, sorry. I was like, yeah, they're one of our sponsors.
Yeah, they're one of our sponsors.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess it's I saw that actually. I saw that Sentry and FreshBooks were sponsors.
Yeah, it's funny. let's talk about our sponsors real quick. We are sponsored by three awesome companies. First one is Content by Kentico. Second one is Hashnode. And third one is Sentry. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. Welcome, Ben. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Do you want to give us a quick rundown of who you are and what you do and what you're interested in? What does your path look like? Because I've been following your stuff for probably well over 10 years back before jQuery days. So it's kind of interesting to see all the stuff you've worked on. I have some books on my shelf that you've written and all that stuff.
Okay, sure. So I'll try to make this slightly interesting. I actually began my professional career in graphics driver development. So I did like a 16-month internship working for Seiko Epson of Japan. Epson, what we think of as the printer company, is actually a giant Japanese conglomerate that also sells watches. And
yeah, Seiko famously watches.
Those companies are always weird to me. Like, I have a Panasonic bike, and then you see like a Samsung excavator sometimes on the side of the road. You're like, some of these companies are so bizarre.
Yeah. At one point, I think they sold personal computers in Japan, like in the same way like Hewlett Packard would.
Oh, yeah.
And they had like an LCD controller business, and I joined like a development team working on a OpenGL ES implementation for some hardware Epson was putting together. So so I did a lot of C, even assembly, and was really like plotting pixels, okay, is how I think about it. Because we're still plotting pixels today. It's all the same stuff, if you think about it. And then at some point, I saw like a, you know, I think I was still in college, and I saw Ajax, okay? Okay, like an endless scrollless demo, really blew my mind.
That. Yeah,
really blew my mind for what websites could be. And I don't know, I somehow pivoted, got into Ruby on Rails, got a job at FreshBooks when I was pretty young, when they were pretty small. And then I was working at FreshBooks for a couple of years. I had an opportunity to move to San Francisco, and I kind of pivoted and decided to be a JavaScript developer. Okay, you know, this is 2010, jQuery, and you know, I was doing like full stack development at FreshBooks, slinging PHP, MySQL, but I really enjoyed the front end. And I began in graphics driver development. I really enjoyed the sort of visual medium. So I went to San Francisco, positioned myself as a JavaScript developer, worked at Disqust for a little bit, the embedded commenting platform. And that's really where, you know, how do you get a web application? You put it on someone else's website. I thought that was really neat. This was really before pure JavaScript applications had really come about. Like, I think at 2010, it was still about, you know, you're using jQuery to augment a PHP app. That's how I think about it. Like, even Facebook was still pretty, you know, click a button, hard refresh, get to the next page back then. So worked there. Worked on embedded comments, came out with this book, Third-Party JavaScript, which is really just kind of taking all the things I'd learned. And that's where I met the founders of Sentry, because Sentry is an open source project that actually goes all the way back to 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. It's actually just like a Django plugin back then. And we can come back to that. But so, you know, I joined Sentry as employee number 4 in 2015. I've been with them this whole time. Became vice president of engineering for like 4 years, grew the engineering team. And today I've got a slightly different job, kind of incubating new products and exploring new stuff that Sentry can do.
And you guys have been doing a lot of new projects lately, not to turn this into like the Sentry ad hour here or something, but like, honestly, one of the things that I'm impressed with at Sentry is like how often I go to my dashboard and there's a new bubble telling me to check out something different, which you got to appreciate in any longstanding company at this point, because so many of these products, they come out, they get either acquired or they just kind of sit and stagnate as, you know, what they were when they launched. But that's never really been the case with you guys. So definitely psyched that you're on that discovery.
It's interesting to hear that from the other side, right? I think that maybe even inside of companies, you're probably like, we're stagnating, and you're freaking out. But maybe with good reason, because that's sort of, you know, that's how you get to this point where you are building new things. That's great to hear, by the way.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, we've been enjoying all the new features and all the bugs that it's catching on our end. I often wonder, like, I wonder if the Sentry team has like a little chat room that just like laughs at, look at Wes's platform. Oh, yeah. Look at how many bugs are on that thing.
I would be lying if I didn't have that same thought at some point, Wes. Like, these people are going to find out that my code is bad.
That definitely never happens. But we do see your like public mentions when you're like, oh, I found this and I fixed a bug. And usually we usually get really amped up when we see that, frankly.
Oh, wicked. Yeah, I just, this morning I just released a huge pack of 10,000 packs of stickers. And like, this code has been running on my platform for a long time. And I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on all my things that pop up. And there's nothing like a lot of traffic to find a whole bunch of weird edge case bugs that people have.
I think our attitude is, and probably you agree, is just like, listen, code is messy. There is no like, I mean, if there's someone out there who's not producing any bugs, who's just figured it out, you know, I don't know, they're probably selling like $10,000 training seminars somewhere, and it's not actually true. Like I just think that we're all making mistakes all the time, and that's just part and parcel of what it means to be a software developer. So, you know, this is the universal experience. I don't think that anyone would make fun of your account if they saw it, because it just looks like everybody else's.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, man, we have a huge list of things we talk about today, but I think like the first thing I want to talk about is you've been publishing these blog posts about distributed tracing for full stack developers. And what does that even mean? Because I think about my Sentry that I've got running here. And this is not necessarily just specific to Sentry, but it's specific to just tracing where things happen. You've got your back end, your front end, but there's a lot of like in between. So you want to give us a rundown of what is distributed tracing?
It's tricky.
Love it.
You know, we live in a more complicated web development world than we did before, right? Even going back to my example of, say, FreshBooks, which is a monolithic PHP app and had some JavaScript, right? Maybe you could say there were sort of two services in there, a front end and a back end. I wouldn't even go that far, frankly. Like, really just a monolith publishing web, you know, publishing, you know, handling requests, running PHP, dropping JavaScript on the page.
Yeah.
You know, and in that paradigm, in that monolithic paradigm that a lot of us, if you've been doing this for a while, are at least familiar with, you know, if an error happens or a page is slow, it's not too hard to figure that out. We, you know, you could use a product like Sentry. There's other products as well. You could have been, you know, just looking at your error log, you could figure it out. But now things have gotten really complicated. Okay. It's, and you talk about new technology all the time. A modern web stack today could be, you know, maybe you still have a monolith, but then you've got some microservices. Maybe some of those are running on serverless. Maybe now today, maybe some of them are on Cloudflare workers running on the edge, right? So you've got serverless even performing, you know, in different places, maybe even on different platforms.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you have a bug, what's responsible? Mm. What's happening? Like when you just see a 500 exception on your browser client, right? something wrong happened. It could be like, who knows? There could be a whole bunch of different services where that error manifested. Okay. And so distributed tracing aims to solve this problem. And I think it kind of emerges because of this kind of confluence of multiple server paradigms, serverless, et cetera. Like just wrapping it together is hard. And tracing is not too tricky. It's really more about just sort of connecting the dots. So when you kick off a request and you initiate some work on some service, you sort of propagate these unique identifiers with your request to downstream services that just sort of say, hey, yes, you're another service. You've got your own thing that you're doing, but this is part of a sort of a connected whole. And by linking these IDs, you can kind of just sort of trace them back to sort of one big gob of stuff. It helps a lot, right? Because if you have an error in a downstream service, you can sort of connect the dots using these unique identifiers to be like, ah, this is the end user that was impacted. I see that it actually affected this upstream service. Like, you know, an exception on this service caused a 500 here, which cascaded to this loading spinner for the user. That's the gist of it. It's not even, I think, too crazy, you know?
Yeah.
When I think about it, I'm like, well, why is this even a new thing? It seems reasonable, you know? Why haven't we had this for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because, like, as you mentioned, things are not essentially as transparent as they were before in the past to you wrote some code, you loaded a single JavaScript file, that file was clearly at fault. But now we have source maps, we have who knows what library, like thousands and thousands of libraries that are called from other libraries, and who really is at fault is always the key problem is where is this issue originating from? So anything that could put those puzzle pieces together, I suppose.
I think that, you know, we also open this from like the full stack view of this, right?
Yeah.
Some of these tools have existed for a while. Sometimes they're like enterprise tools and they were like DevOps tools, you know, like you're a sysadmin, you're a DevOps person, you're looking at this network topology, this service map. And like, this is a tool for me with my puppet master fingers, you know, controlling the giant server infrastructure of some company. Okay. So those products have existed. And one of the first sort of quote unquote consumer versions of this is Amazon X-Ray. I think like if you're using services, like Amazon has something, which is if you're using multiple services, they have some basic kind of, you know, connecting the dots.
Yeah.
Do you know more about this, Wes?
No. Sorry. I'm just agreeing with you. I'm taking a look at it. I've never heard of this, the Amazon X-Ray before. I'm not a big AWS user though.
And that's part of it. You hadn't heard of it. And if you look at it, it's pretty low level. Okay. You know, because it was sort of a tool for like almost just like another segment of developer, right?
Yeah.
But also, so not only do we have this kind of services rise, but we also have this like rise of front-end developers and full-stack developers that I think have like an increasing responsibility over these services, right? Like you guys talk about it. You guys talk about workers. You guys talk about these new technologies, right?
Yeah, it's unreal. The past like couple years, all of a sudden Next.js gives us API routes and oops, I'm a back-end dev all of a sudden. Like that's, we're seeing a lot of people being like, oh, I don't know if I'm a front-end or back-end. Am I full-stack? It's like, I kind of just write the code and it runs where it needs to run. And before you know it, I'm back end or maybe even operations, right?
Yeah, the tooling has evolved to such a degree and simplified that, you know, we're all comfortable using these things. I'm roped into this too. Like I'm not somebody who is going in and like configuring Nginx and doing a whole bunch of wacky sysadmin DevOps things. I really like serverless. I like calling a URL and some magic computation happens that I've set up.
Yes.
So like, you know, you take all these things together and that, I guess, you know, this is my own like advocacy that these are helpful tools. These are helpful tools for the modern, you know, full stack landscape.
That's another interesting thing you have here. I want to get into this is that like poor experience is not necessarily an error. Like if your website is slow or like you got a spinny forever and it just like never resolves or whatever reason, or it times out, or just in general, the website just doesn't feel good or sort of rots over time. I talk about that a lot, right? Like where your website's nice when it goes out, but over the years, things get slower and nothing is necessarily throwing a flag for that. So does distributed tracing also help in that of just like tracking down like a poor user experiences?
Yeah, I think this is incredibly important for front-end developers too, right? Because typically, think about this. We obsess over file size. We obsess over things like, first time to byte, largest contentful paint, some of the things that we have control over. But the reality is, oftentimes, like we're still waiting on a server response is usually the crux of a slow experience. Would you agree
with that? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So, tracing also lets you, tracing isn't just sort of like, oh, an error happens in this service and you can trace that to an experience, but it can be used to augment really anything like APM tools, performance monitoring tools. So I can take a look at this slow end user experience and I can trace through, because this, again, it's really just IDs augmenting telemetry that sort of helps you connect the dots. And so modern performance monitoring tools will basically show you a sort of topology of your request. It's like, okay, here's the front end experience. Here's a fetch request that hits a server. That seems to be taking a while to hear back from. Oh, because it turns out that server is in turn calling some other service. And, the version of this that we're probably most familiar with is a database, right?
Yeah.
So, because that's a long query. But maybe it's service, then a database, right? And, these tools really help you connect the dots in a way where you're like, well, here's my problem, right? My problem is right over here. And me as a software developer, I can keep going and trying to shave file size off of my dependencies, but it might actually just be more meaningful if I roll up my sleeves and figure out how I can optimize this sort of like server endpoint for my users.
Yeah. That kind of like makes me think of we have this shift of testing more towards like integration testing of like act as close to the user experience as possible. Whereas in years past, it was more like unit testing and testing that function that runs. And this kind of feels like the same way as like you should be tracking and tracing it as the user experiences it and not necessarily like bytes and whatnot at the end of the day, right? Does that make any sense?
I like this. It's the unit test versus the integration test.
Yeah.
Is true, right? Yeah. You can't just look, you can't, if you just, hey, I've done this, mock all the server endpoints, right? Right. Write a bunch of tests that fire up your components, but you're not testing the full system, right? And I might even look at that and call that an integration test because it wasn't like, it wasn't me sort of testing just a function or a method on a class.
Yeah, pure function, right? Like, and out. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I should also add on this, like these tracing capabilities are finding their way into commodity tools and products, right? Sentry's one of them. There are others. I think Elastic does this too. I want to talk about another open source option here. I feel the need to highlight that,
totally.
The only ones doing this. It's a trend. People should look into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually amazing that you can just sign up for something and throw it on your site and actually be able to get this. This feels like something that used to be like you had to like have a call with people and
you
have to fill out vendor forms and all that. I remember those days, and like that's just not something that anyone's really interested in doing or has budget to do that type of thing. If you need to have a phone call, you probably can't afford it.
Yeah. because you've talked about Cloudflare on your show, and I'm a big fan of some of the things they do. Cloudflare is like a version of that for CDNs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right, does everything for you. Everything for you, yeah. We should actually take a quick second here to talk about one of our sponsors, which is Content by Kinetico. Wes, do you want to talk about Content by Kinetico?
Yes, Content by Kentico is it's a headless CMS that you can use for building your website. It's both for marketers and for developers. It's kind of funny. You go to their website. It's content with a K, .ai, and they have links just both for the marketing team as well as developers. And I think that's good when they think about both of those people that are going to be using a product at the end of the day. One of their clients is, Scott just pointed this out, Cadbury Egg. Delicious. I would absolutely love to use it. It's really cool. I love any CMS that puts code on their sales page, right? Like, this is not like sometimes you go to these websites and it's just a whole bunch of salesy topic. And you're like, come on, like, show me actually what it looks like. So they've got examples in React, Angular, Vue.NET, PHP, Swift, Android, Java, you name it. So all you have to do is hook up to their API. You can pull in all the data into literally any framework that you're using. Awesome UI, really, really good. So check it out at content.ai/syntax. That's KONTENT.ai/syntax. You can spin up a brand new project on that URL. Thank you, Content by Kentico, for sponsoring. I have a question about the Cloudflare integration. I'm not sure how much you know about that, but when Cloudflare Workers runs on its own custom JavaScript, right? Like, it's not Node and it's not like browser, right? They've cooked up their own. Do you know anything more about that?
V8 isolates. I have a cursory understanding, and I can tell you that part of, because it is a different environment, like, we can't actually instrument that environment the same way that we can Node or the browser.
Oh yeah. And did you have any hand in getting Sentry working on Cloudflare Workers? Like, was it, do you have to do anything special? Because we talked about Cloudflare Workers in a couple episodes ago, and we were saying, like, yeah, it's like a, it's its own thing, and there's trade-offs, and there's huge benefits to it as well.
We have a dialogue with them. I actually think they did most of it.
Oh, wow.
Because they are Sentry open source users, like self-hosted users. They wrote their own. There was an example up there in their sort of library of things. But don't quote me on that. That's just like I recall.
That's really cool. So I guess so they use Sentry over at Cloudflare as well to track their own?
I believe so. They've got some open source contributions, and they've got a fork or something floating around.
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
I'd like to point to this as evidence.
That's cool. And maybe that's my next question is like why does Sentry just give away their entire business model for free? Like, if you don't know, like, you can pay for Sentry. They sponsor this podcast. It's a successful business, but you can also just host it yourself and it's entirely open source. Like, how does that work when a business is entirely open source?
That is a big topic. Yeah. There's a lot of businesses with different open source business models. I think the easy answer is that, one, Sentry began as an open source project. So, there it is. The decision was made when that project emerged and sort of people started using it. And the origin of the business is that people basically approached the founder of Sentry, David Kramer, and they were like, hey, this is cool. I use it. I like it. I don't really want to run and maintain and upgrade and to back it up and to secure it. Like, can I just pay you? That's that's the story. and I think version one, like, you had to actually pay for it on the Heroku store. I never went through this purchasing flow. It may or may not still exist today, but you couldn't actually go and have a subscription through Sentry itself. Like, it was sort of like an add-on in a
Heroku add-on.
The whole Heroku add-on thing was definitely a weird time, right? Because it's like creating an account and connecting services. But I always felt like it was just a little too like, where is this account living? Who owns what here? Yeah. I always thought that was a little weird.
I remember that with MongoDB as well.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I'm making a database. Compose, it's not you, but it's through you, but it's not you,
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a bit odd.
I never used Heroku back in the day because I just like, I could just imagine the pricing slider we were talking about. Like, the pricing slider is great. I'm like, man, it seems expensive. Maybe it was OneNode.
Very expensive. Yeah. Yeah. Especially expensive when you compared to any of the VPS providers.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. It's funny. People always talk about how amazing some of these things are. And then I look over at my $5 a month Linode or DigitalOcean or something like that. It's like, oh yeah, that's pretty good.
I saw something on Hacker News the other day that was like 30 cents a month hosting. Like that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
No way. Really?
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's being commoditized to such a degree that we're getting it down to pennies. I actually think that's great.
As long as someone else is managing my SSL certificates, I will pay a premium just so I don't have to deal with SSL. But yeah, I will take cheap hosting as well.
Man, I very clearly remember the Hacker News article when DigitalOcean launched. It said $5 a month SSD hosting, and that was like, what? Like they're putting SSDs in their servers and it's only $5 a month? Like unreal.
It was also kind of a time where people were like really trying to jump off the Media Temple ship. They had been acquired by GoDaddy and everyone was like, well, what are we going to do? Yeah.
Yeah.
Media Temple. This is just this throwback.
It's crazy that Media Temple is still around. You haven't heard any, like they sponsored a conference I was at a couple of years ago and I was like, oh yeah, Media Temple. And like, I feel like people that are on Media Temple are going to be on there for life because you're not necessarily, I have one of those. I got a Bluehost server that has, tons of stuff on it. Right. And I have no idea. And I probably will never cancel that because like the day that I cancel that is like, my family has websites on it and I don't even know there's older backed up stuff on it. That's why people love those Media Temple servers, is probably because people just buy them and pay for them forever.
I mean, it's at the point, I mean, I had DreamHost, pick your host, you know, cause you shell into it and you're like, what do I even have here? And you just do the math.
What is this? What are these IP addresses here? Let's go through each one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You do the math and you're like, I think I'll just keep paying $5 a month rather than attempt to figure this out.
It's so true. I'm going through that right now. I'm on DigitalOcean, like $5 a month. Mm-hmm. And I have a huge Let's Encrypt setup and like all these config files with Apache and stuff like that. And I'm trying to move over to App Platform, which is just like, it automates all of that. And I was just like, I know way too much about Apache or not Apache, Nginx and configs and all that stuff.
So I think, listen, I'm going to use this to segue back to Sentry because it's very relevant, right? I mentioned the origin is an open source business, okay? Definitely true. That's what sets the stage. And I think that is a big part of Sentry's popularity today because it's just, you know, a lot of shops just set it up. It's helpful, you know, easy to get going. And also Sentry for a long time used sort of like really commodity open source technology that people were comfortable running. Postgres. It's Postgres and Redis for a very long time.
Yeah.
So much so that like impacted our roadmap. We would think about, we wanted to keep that true for a very long time, which caused us to get really creative about what product features we could use because there was sort of an inherent like scale limitation when you're using some of those technologies. Today, it's more complicated. At some point, we crossed the line, which was like, we want to keep innovating. Okay, Scott, you mentioned this, like come up with new features. So, you know, we adopted some new technologies like Kafka, and ClickHouse, which if you're not familiar with it, it's an open source column store database worth looking into. It was spun out of Yandex a couple of years ago. It's something that they built to run their own sort of version of Google Analytics. Okay. It is a ClickHouse. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's a columnar. Man, that is a hard word. Columnar, OLAP. Database management system for real-time analytics using SQL. Yeah, so there's that.
So listen, I don't know how to run that software, okay? And and the reality is that Sentry has become more complicated. I mean, it was always complicated, I would say, to run at scale, but it has become inherently more complicated. We do provide a Docker container. Like, I think we make it pretty easy to get going if you want to do that. I fired up our developer environment very recently, you know, just a couple of weeks ago from scratch. Didn't take me very long to get it running, maybe an hour. So it's relatively easy to get started. But, you know, if you start using it in a serious way, okay, what you got to maintain multiple database technologies, you got to back it up, you got to secure it, you got to apply patches.
Yeah.
I'm tired, you know?
Yeah.
And you're tired. We're all tired. And, you know, we don't, you know, Sentry starts at like $30 a month. So it's not like a pricey product here. Might also reflect the fact that it is self-hosted, right? And just as I don't want to go into Dreamhouse and like figure out, you know, oh, I'm running an 8-year-old version of Ruby. Let me upgrade that so I can,
yeah,
you know, publish my Jekyll website again. I'd rather just, I'm just going to pay the money. Like, frankly, it's worth it to me. And I think that that's more or less, it's the same reason why, you know, use a lot of cloud providers today, right? There are open source serverless platforms that you can run and do everything yourself. Okay. You can run it on bare metal and run out to the data center and do it that way if you wanted to, right? So I think it's just really an evolution of the evolving cloud paradigm, right? That's what I think.
Yeah. And also, you know, you don't really want to spend time debugging your exception handling software. It's like, I don't need an exception handling software to handle my exceptions for my out of date exception handling software.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's just not something I need to deal with.
I have the same thing with like smart home stuff in my house. Anytime I talk about it, people are always like, why are you not like hosting this inside? Like you could throw it on a Raspberry Pi. And I was like, I am not spending my evenings debugging my doorbell because like I'm tired. We're all tired, you know?
We're all tired.
I don't have time for that. Take my $5 a month. I'm gonna sit on the couch in the evening instead of SSHing into a Raspberry Pi and flashing something with it. And like also like you don't want to disrupt the business, or in my case, I don't want to disrupt the family of like, why are the light switches not working? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I'm working on it, right? Like you just want it to work so you can focus on like the actual business at hand.
Mm-hmm. It's like the increased industrialization of our, you know, industry. And, you know, oftentimes in a business, like the biggest way that you can produce value is by solving the business needs, right? Right? Build the business logic, build the workflows, build the product that people want to use, and not to get down in the dirt on the muck. Like, you know, a million analogies for this. I'm just repeating myself.
That's fine. I had a good transition here about being so tired, and we're all very tired. So
let's hear it.
Yeah. Why not start a blog because you're so tired, but which software are you going to pick? Where are you going to host it? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to set it all up? Which static site server are you going to pick? This static site generator? Okay. I picked this one. Now this other one's popular. So I guess I need to start it over. No, you should start your blog on Hashnode because Hashnode gives you a lot of really awesome options for starting that blog of yours, because not only is this a third-party platform that allows you to have a blog in mere seconds, you also get to own all of your content. It backs it up into your own Git repo. As in, if you're writing all these blog posts, you don't have to worry about these living in someone else's CMS. It's impossible to export. You have them just straight up in GitHub in Markdown files. And this platform is based on Next.js, so it feels very comfortable to use. Not only that, it brings you all the tools that you might want to have with this thing, a free SSL certificate. You can write in a GUI instead of having to code up a blog post and a Markdown file in your own site. And it even lets you use your own URL, so you can collect all of that awesome Google sitemap stuff where everyone is linking to your blog post and it's linking directly to your own URL. So if you want to try it out, head on over to hashnode.com, sign up for your own free blog today. Yeah, that's right. Free to get started, free to use. And you can even get your stuff picked up in their Explore tab and all sorts of awesome things. So check it out. A really awesome blogging platform that, again, you get to own your content yourself, which is such a huge thing that we always talk about over here. So thanks so much for Hashnode for sponsoring.
My question is about, I always like to hear what the stack is of huge things. And I don't know if you can rattle off the entire stack because it sounds like you're saying things that I don't even know what they are, like ClickHouse. But like, what was it initially built on? And like, what is it run on now? Are you using serverless? Do you use Sentry in Sentry? How does that work? So there's a bunch of questions for you there.
Okay, I'll start with the stack and then I'll come back to that other part. So Sentry began as a Django plugin, and Django had a plugin architecture. I was not, you know, at this point in time, like I wouldn't call myself a Python developer at all. I was doing PHP, so I can only speak too much to it, but I did use Rails. And I think Rails had something analogous to that.
Yeah.
And the first version of Sentry literally just effectively just created a fingerprint on a stack trace. So Django itself actually had something built in, which is when you had an exception, email me. And you had to provide, you know, the SMTP server and the credentials, yeah, and it would email you. And as the story goes, David Kramer, as a founder, you know, his inbox got flooded one day, you know, and with the same error happening, he was building something. I think it went viral or something. So he just got inundated with the same exception.
Mm. It's like, this is not how I want this flow to go.
Yeah. But it was still somewhat innovative. Like, I don't think Rails had that. This was maybe 2008. So 2008, 2009. So he built something that's sort of like very, the commit is still there, by the way. This is the same repository. So you could go to the very first commit and take a look at it. But it more or less just sort of created a fingerprint of similar exceptions and then added a table in Postgres administered through Django and just sort of, you know, incremented counts and emailed you if something was new. Okay. Which is not too different from how it operates today. The same fundamental thesis of it. So, you know, that was a pure Django plugin, right? So whether it was Postgres or MySQL, I think that was probably all abstracted at the ORM, right? Like there was no infrastructure for Sentry. It was just pure code built on top of the framework. You know, it's gone through a bunch of evolutions, so I don't want to, you know, I could sit here talking for the next 20 minutes, but I'll just go to how it is today. You know, it's still primarily Django. Not quite the latest version, but a relatively modern version. We did convert actually the front end. The front end is React. I know you talk a lot about React is out there. Interestingly though, and this was right when I joined, you know, we rebuilt the UI in React in 2015, which I want to say was a relatively, I don't want to say
very early,
edge,
yeah.
A little
yeah.
early.
Yeah,
that was early. Yeah.
And it uses like a flux pattern, but uses Reflux, which is sort of a not a super maintained library today. Still use it though. We converted everything to TypeScript a year or two ago, which is pretty neat.
Oh yeah.
So actually, I do encourage people to look at Sentry as like, you know, it's an open source app, and it's a React and a TypeScript app. I think there's like 100,000 lines of React and TypeScript. Like if you're ever looking for examples,
holy smokes,
you know, there's not a lot like that. Another one, by the way, is WordPress's client front end called Calypso. They rewrote that a few years ago, and that's open source. And I used to look there for inspiration. So, you know, if you're working in a company, you're like, how do people do this? I did that all the time.
Go to see what the highly used real world apps are using in open source. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably a lot messier than you think, which is okay. It'll probably make you feel better. Okay.
I remember it was less than a year ago. There was a blog post on the Sentry blog about how they converted the entire front end to TypeScript, which is like 100,000 lines of code being converted to TypeScript. So I would highly recommend you give that a read over, because like I'm looking at converting my platform to TypeScript right now, and it is a small fraction of that. And I kind of just sitting there being like, where do I even start with this? You know? And like, I can't imagine like, what was that like, the big move over? You can obviously read through the entire blog post of how you did it, but like, were you part of that process?
So Sentry has like, organizationally, you know, it's about 100 engineers today, the company. We're kind of divided into mission-based teams. Like, hey, you're working on the performance product. You're working on the errors product. Or you're working to really make sure Sentry's great with the JavaScript, different JavaScript environments, Node, right? So we're kind of split up into different groups like that. And inevitably, organizations are like, well, who's coordinating? You know, how do all the front end developers get together and make any sense of what they're doing when they're on different teams? So we have like an internal kind of steering committee. This is in the blog post, I think. that is, you know, loosely modeled off of the Node TSC, which is, you know, you come with a proposal. I want to make these changes. That could be as simple as, hey, I hate these var statements. Can we switch all these to const? Like that was an early example of something that gets debated in this group. And then, you know, switching everything to TypeScript also kind of as a proposal gets sort of presented. Here's why, here's the problems we're trying to solve, right? I think my role in that is really, I mean, I was a vice president of engineering at the time. So it was more kind of like, hey, how do we not spend forever doing this? And two, I'm really nervous about big kind of migrations that get to like a half finished state because we got bored with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if people can resonate with that, but.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Especially with like a huge code base and, you know, you can only code mod so much of it. Cause if you think about it, like the types, you gotta know, you gotta sort of examine and understand, and make some declarations. So we actually had a rule. I guess this is a rule I was pretty adamant about, which is no major refactoring till we complete this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like no other second thing. So a good example is okay. I mentioned we had, we still have this older Flux library, which I don't think is very maintained. If that's not true, I'm sorry. Reflux maintainers, I'm not trying to sow any discord here. And that's been something that people have talked about internally, like, hey, can we use Reflux? Can we use MobX? We talk about this stuff. And it's more like, put a pin on that. We have to finish this other thing first.
Yeah.
You know, and it took us, I think, almost a year and a half door to door, so to speak, to complete that project, 100,000 lines of code.
Wow.
And it takes some rigor, I guess, is what I think what I'm saying, right? To undertake that. But I don't know, that was our experience. I think it helped. And, you know, I enjoy the code base today.
Yeah. We did a similar, I mean, we converted all of ours to TypeScript at some point, and that was such just a burden to get that done. But you put a pin in it, you say this is all we're going to be doing until it's done, we're done, and then now it's probably a lot better to work in. And I resisted it for a long time, just in general, just because you never know what's going to be the winner. You don't want to convert everything to TypeScript if I don't even, what were some of the other options? Flow, is that one of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah,
if flows out there, whatever. But making, so it's a huge bet. And making that huge bet is such a big thing. But man, having a typed code base at this point feels very nice, right?
You could probably go from code mod flow to TypeScript, though, as an example. Like it's sort of the intent, capturing the intent is the hardest part.
Code mod scare me so much for some reason. Getting to examine all the files, I don't know what it is about it. Like modifying that many things triggers something inside of me.
There were other articles going on around at the time when we were taking this on, and I don't want to name companies, but it's like I want to cite these articles in case you want to look them up. Like I feel like Airbnb could have been one where like there had been like 5-year efforts to convert these code bases, very sort of like let's do it casually as we go, and you know they have the graph of like, you know, one line is number of JavaScript files at a time, the other one is TypeScript files at a time, and just the idea of like a 5-year odyssey, and it wasn't, and not being finished really seemed bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that. I just had to. I would have to just like sit down, lock myself in the room. I bet I could do mine in a week. It's probably not as big as any of these things, but still like hokey.
It is tough as an organization, right? Like I would say that in those first, in probably your experience is similar, like in that first 3 to 6 months, like it felt like a slog, you know, still learning TypeScript, not as comfortable. Everything feels like it takes 2 to 3 more time.
Making bad choices. Everything's getting in your way. To fix those choices. Yeah.
Obscure errors.
Yep.
And so I understand, like there's still the TypeScript drama on Twitter today. There's still sort of it doesn't feel closed. And I totally understand that because I remember that period, but I would say today when everything's there and everything auto-completes, you could jump to whatever file, especially in a big code base, it's self-documenting. Oh.
It complains when you build. Yeah.
I have just a very question. I'm not sure if this will pan out, but I'm going to go for it. But do you have any weird stories about trying to run JavaScript on other people's websites? I have enough trouble trying to run JavaScript on my own website, but much of your career has been between Discuss and Sentry. Not all of Sentry runs on people's, but like the JavaScript often runs in environments that are controlled by other people. And I remember you talking to Darcy about, I think this was you, is like, how do you get a clean DOM with no filtered global methods or anything like that? And I remember being like, how would you ever do that? And the answer was that you make an iframe and you grab the window out of that. But did you ever run upon any like weird head scratchers of running JavaScript in someone else's?
There's an effort to sort of standardize a function that is something like get original built-ins that gives you clean sort of like unaltered versions of sort of like browser built-in. So if you're interested in the easy answer to that question, perhaps in a few years, there will be a sort of API in the browser that you can use. There's some other random wacky ones. This was actually one of my interview questions for Discuss was a sort of weird JavaScript trivia that was this question. Okay. And this is in the prologue to my book.
Oh, this really? Okay.
This little story. I'm laughing now because I'm like, wow, what a piece of random trivia to ask someone.
just drone people. Yeah.
But it was that question, which is if you have an altered sort of like built-in method, you know, like, and an example by this for listeners could be like get elements by tag name, right? Technically speaking, you bring in some third-party JavaScript, nothing stopping that JavaScript from going in, changing that method, you know, putting a wrapper around it and doing something with it. And I got asked that question in an interview. And I didn't know the answer. So I actually, in the middle of the interview, opened up my developer console and started playing around. And one solution I discovered in the middle of that interview is that if you actually call delete on a property, it turns out, at least at the time, this was 2010, but Safari was the only browser that would actually exhibit this. It would actually return the original property on a built-in. So this was a sort of like really fringe, like not standardized browser behavior thing.
Yeah.
And the interviewer didn't know that answer either. So I was just dorking around and came up with it. So there's more than just the iframe. The iframe is the easiest way today. You know, in that era, you got to remember that there are even just libraries that, like Scriptaculous or Prototype.js, do you remember those?
Yeah.
Prototype.js literally just sort of altered all the built-ins.
Example. Like it would take the, like, for example, we never had dot contains or dot includes on an array, but Prototype just added it. And then down the road, when we did get it, it was a bit of an issue because they weren't the same thing, right?
Yes. It took a lot of the ideas from Ruby on Rails and some of the things that kind of made Ruby on Rails fun. Like, yeah, oh, wow, all these kind of like natural language methods on objects to do things, right? Like has a, right? Array has a, and some of those methods now exist, right? Is there a dot has now? I think there is.
Dot
has is on a set.
Or
a
includes?
Set has dot has. Includes is on an array and a set has a has.
I think includes is like a ES2015 thing. I don't think it was original.
And the reason why it's not dot contains is because of Prototype.js.
I'm on this website for like the first time in a billion years right now, and I'm on Prototype. It's hitting me. I mean, it feels like a relic in trapped in amber. It's amazing.
It was a world when modifying, you know, the sort of like built-in browser APIs was pretty normal.
Yeah.
And so in that landscape, we found a bunch of wacky stuff. Like, yeah, Prototype was always a pain in the ass, but some people would just like randomly alter built-ins. I remember one website that was causing us endless grief. This was some publisher's website. I couldn't tell. It could have been like an MLB or an IGN. Discuss was like on a lot of big media properties at the time.
Yeah.
And they had a custom array push implementation, array.prototype.push. And a radar prototype to push is not like a new method. Okay. So they were actually creating a new one. And I think this is an example of where people get tripped up. I don't know why they did it. It was a perfectly fine array prototype to push in the sense of like, if you used it in the standard way, okay, push an item, it goes onto the array, right? But what you may not know is that I think array dot prototype to push actually can take up to n arguments. Okay.
Yeah, multiple.
Yes. And so their implementation never counted for this. Right. and you know, we just had code. You just had, you know, you generally operated on the idea that you can use
You can use the language. Push. You can use the language as it exists. Yeah. Yeah. things that have been around as long as push.
Yeah, that was pretty. Yeah, it was pretty. It was a pretty stressful thing to develop on because you would sort of deploy this application on, you know, some company's website, and then you'd have to go and have a conversation, which is like, you are breaking the contract, you know?
Yeah,
you are breaking a rule here.
But they would look at you and be like, "Well, your stuff is broken, right?" And so you have
your software doesn't run on our site.
Mm-hmm. And then in a big organization, you're like, well, who is even responsible for injecting this weird JavaScript code that's floating around somewhere? Oftentimes it's minified, right? So you got to figure that out. And that's actually why I discussed in the early, you know, at some point did a big rewrite and put everything in an iframe. I was a big proponent of that because I was just, bring it back full circle. I was tired.
Yeah. Yes, I love it. That's definitely the theme.
Wow. That's a good story.
Yeah, if you're tired, a great service that you can have to be a little bit more tired. Something like Sentry. Let me tell you, I was tired this weekend because I had a lot of bugs coming in to Sentry, and it's not Sentry's fault. It was my fault. I pushed an update on Friday, and it caused some bugs in my application, and I was not prepared for the emails that I was going to receive. And so I had to wake up early on a Saturday and code my butt off to fix this deploy that I shouldn't have done on a Friday at 4. I was also breaking the contract there. I was breaking the contract by deploying at Friday at 4. It was easy to solve once I had the information sitting there in front of me, which is really what Sentry does so well. And Sentry allows you to see all of the errors and exceptions happening, taking place on your application, how many times, how many users, who they're affecting, when it was introduced, just all that and more. It's one of those services that, again, once you hit a thing like this and you wake up, and you get some regression alerts, or you get some errors have increased alerts, or whatever you have set up with your Sentry, you'll be very thankful that you had it, because I was able to at least get onto this while people were emailing me. Sure, people were emailing me, but I was able to get on it before too many people started emailing me, and it wasn't Monday, and I'm like, oh, shoot, I had something happen on this weekend. So, thank you to Sentry for saving my bacon this weekend in a real life code emergency that I had to jump on. So thank you to Sentry for sponsoring this podcast. And if you want to sign up and try out Sentry, you just head on over to sentry.io. You use the coupon code TASTYTREAT. It's all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. Thank you so much for Sentry for sponsoring.
How has that been?
That's great. I mean,
we've never had a sponsor on the podcast where they also sponsor it. So there you go.
And also one that's as applicable as me using it all the time.
Kidding. Yeah. That's what we like so much about this podcast is all of our sponsors are things that we actually use and can talk about so freely. All right. Let's get into the next section of this podcast, which is sick picks. This is where we pick things that are sick. We could be literally anything, could be an app, could be a piece of food, could be a hot sauce, could be a vacuum, you name it. Ben, did you come prepared today with a sick pick?
I did not come prepared. So can I go last? I'm gonna think a little bit. Yeah.
Sure. I got a really good one, and I am going to sick pick. I've been sick picking a bunch of hot sauces lately, and I'm going to pick something that is hot sauce adjacent. And it is a kimchi seasoning mix. And this is not seasoning that makes kimchi. This is like a shaker that tastes like kimchi that you could put on anything. It's called the Seoul Sisters Korean Kimchi Powder Seasoning. And you can put this stuff on anything. I've been putting it on. It's spicy and umami, and I've been putting it on popcorn and grilled chicken breasts and chicken thighs and on vegetables and literally anything you want. It tastes awesome on everything. I was very happy. I had to send it to my sister in the States because all good things in Canada are unavailable. So I had to send them off to my sister and smuggle it across the border. But if you are in the States, you can get access to it. I'll link it up in the show notes.
Sick. Nice one, Wes. I'm going to sick pick a podcast that I've sick picked before, but they have a new season out. This podcast is called Last Scene. And Wes, you might actually like season one of this because it's like, ooh, 10 episodes on the Gardner Art Museum heist that you seem to like that Netflix documentary on.
Yes.
So the first season is all on that. But like the second season, they're doing not heists, but it's like things that have gone missing. So there's like three episodes about various things. Some of them are heist related, but not necessarily explicitly. And so it's just like, here are some things that have gone missing, and we're going to investigate where they are or talk to the people who know the most about them. They also did like a nice little side episode on the Amber Room, which I'm super fascinated by. I don't know if you're familiar with the Amber Room. It was like a big decorative room that was made entirely out of amber decorations. It was super fragile. And then World War II happened and the Germans tried to steal it from the Russians. And who knows where it ended up, right? Where did this thing go? So a lot of like really fun mystery type of deals, but like with a history twist on it. So something I'm very interested in. Last Scene, really neat, really nice podcast.
So I'm coming in now.
Something? Yeah.
Well, now, you know, since we're talking about hot sauces and podcasts, I'm gonna hat tip a podcast that I've appeared on that is not a development podcast, that is, ooh, a film podcast. And because you said Last Scene, this is called, it made me think of it, it's called Worst Scene, Best Scene.
Oh, I don't know this.
It's a small film podcast by some San Francisco filmmakers slash, you know, part-time or former stand-up comedians slash tech workers. And the contrivance of the podcast is they take a good movie and take a bad movie and they compare the worst scene in the good movie to the best scene in the bad movie. And then, you know, what was better. And it's just like a fun reason to just talk about movies. I love talking about movies.
I listen to a lot of movie podcasts like Blank Check. Are you familiar with Blank Check? That's a good one too.
I've heard it cited, but I haven't listened to it.
Yeah, it's really just it's about directors who, you know, amassed great success and have been given a blank check. Yeah, so you know, their Verhoeven series is really great. Or sometimes they get into like 10 movies about a director I kind of don't care about. But when it's a director that I do care about, like the Singleton films, they do all Fast and Furious and stuff like that. I mean, that can be a lot of fun. So yeah, I like Blank Check. I'll give this Best Scene, Worst Scene check.
Yeah. How did this get made? Also great, but that's popular one.
Totally. Yeah. A lot of fun. I Was There Too was really good. Do you ever get into I Was There Too? They interview actors who were also in great films.
You're deep in movie podcasts.
I am. I went to like media school. So yeah, I'm deep into it. But I Was There Too is like interviewing the guy who played Jar Jar Binks or interviewing this actor who was also in The Godfather, but nobody thinks of, you know, just to give what their experiences were like as not the main character in some giant film property. Yeah. Film podcast.
Wow, Scott is that's probably the one thing that Scott and I have the least amount in common of is watching movies. Like Scott probably subscribes to more movie podcasts than I have watched movies.
Yeah, I do. I do subscribe to a lot of film podcasts.
Love all the. I'm really bummed that heist podcast stopped.
Oh, I never liked it. Those guys were kind of goofy to me.
Yeah. Oh, they're, oh man, those guys are from Hamilton, so maybe that's why I like them.
Too Canadian for me. Yeah.
Too Canadian. Yeah. Ben, you're from Canada too, right?
You're back
in Canada now?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I dropped that I moved to San Francisco, but I did move back to Toronto in the last year. Yeah.
Oh, right on. It actually one more thing I want to ask you about is that you mentioned Ontario hiring and like software hiring has changed. What do you mean by that?
Just coming in after the hot picks.
Yeah, we're back. We're back into the podcast. We can go for as long as we want. It's our podcast. Oh, yeah.
Listen, the pandemic caused a lot of upheaval and movement, and certainly like there's a, I think everyone's very aware of the sort of remote working upheaval, right? Everybody had to do it. But there is also, you know, where have people been remote working from has changed a lot too. It's not just that people moved to the country, it's that people moved countries. You know, I can name, you know, four or five other people who made a similar trip, US to Canada. People from, you know, whether it's GitHubers or people at NPM or people at Google, you know, a lot of people move to Canada, move to wherever country. And so I think that that's, you know, that's actually affected the local labor market. I think that, you know, that also means that companies are set up to employ in Canada that maybe they weren't. You know, you actually got to go and set stuff up. If you want, as an employee, you want to have benefits, you want to have payroll, right? And so there's a lot more. Just a lot more software companies and Bay Area software companies in Ontario and Canada. And I think it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. You can definitely tell. You should see my Twitter DMs of how many people are moving to Hamilton now because they are working remotely. You can definitely see it in the house prices.
Yeah. I'm not going to touch that one. It's probably the best.
That's an economics podcast.
You know, but I think the really cool thing about this is that when we emerge from this, like, yeah, Ontario is going to be a very different landscape for technology companies, you know?
Totally.
At the very beginning of this, I was like, hey, do your listeners know about FreshBooks? And I think that's because if you're in Ontario and you're in tech, like FreshBooks is a pretty big kind of outfit, you know, because there just wasn't a lot of startups here. You know, Shopify, obviously a huge one. FreshBooks, PagerDuty to a degree is sort of a Toronto, San Francisco thing. Yeah, it's not like a huge list. And I think that's changing dramatically. Just a lot of satellite outfits opening up, you know, the talent landscape. And this also means that other people, you know, people are going to start new companies, start new startups here, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
So yeah, I'm just kind of hyped for it all.
Oh, Canada. Awesome. Thanks for putting your two cents in there. Let's move to the next section, which is shameless plugs. This is where we plug anything that we want shamelessly. I'll shamelessly plug all of my courses at westboss.com/courses. Use coupon code Syntax for $10 off. You can learn beginner JavaScript or Master Gatsby or React for Beginners. You name it.
Yes, I will shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. where you can learn all about the latest and greatest in new front-end languages and stuff. In fact, we just had a new course from the very talented and very exciting Amy Dunn, who does a course on Keystone.js, which is a platform for building Node apps. And let me tell you, Amy is just one of those types of teachers where her teaching style is high energy in the best kind of way, where it's very the type of engaging person where you want to listen to. And I really enjoy listening to Amy talk. So give her course a try. It's called Keystone.js on leveluptutorials.com. You can sign up to become a pro and save 25% if you sign up for the year. Thank you for myself for that one.
All right. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming on. That was really fun. Really interesting to talk to you about all those topics. Appreciate it. And yeah, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
I had fun. Thanks so much.
All right. Peace.
Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.